Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu. Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, your producer emeritus, filling in for your regular host, David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. During this hour, Focus 580 will be talking about the war on terror and its impact on human rights. Our guest is someone who is rather in the thick of dealing with human rights issues around the world, a job which has been considerably more challenging since September 11th, 2001. William Schultz is Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, which is at the forefront of organizations working to bring the ideals of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights into reality. Dr. Schultz is also an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister and served for 8 years as the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations prior to becoming the head of Amnesty International USA in 1994. He has participated in many international missions, writes and speaks frequently in the major press, and is the author of several books, including In Our Own Best Interests, How Defending Human Rights Benefits Us All, and Tainted Legacy, 9/11 and the Ruin of Human Rights. Also, William Schultz will be speaking in Urbana-Champaign tomorrow at noon at the University YMCA, part of their Friday Forum Noontime Lecture Series. The address, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign. That is free and open to the public, so you should feel free to attend if you'd like to do that. And we're also happy to have William Schultz with us by telephone this morning on Focus 580. As we talk about human rights and the war on terror with William Schultz, you are invited into our conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else you hear us, use our toll-free line, and that's good anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. William Schultz, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
Thanks so much for your time.
Pleasure.
In talking about the impact of the war on terror on human rights, where do we even start?
Well, we start, I think, with the fact that the war on terror has transformed our understanding of human rights positively and negatively. You know, the number of people who are active terrorists, who are training to blow up cities, is really a modest number. Even the most conservative experts suggest that we're talking about thousands of people, not tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. But every terrorist requires a retinue, a support system, a community behind their efforts if they're going to survive. They have to physically live somewhere. They have to have a ready pool from which to recruit new terrorists. They have to have financial support. And it is that retinue of people, those people who could go either way in the war on terror, who are most readily influenced by the United States and its allies and how they treat issues of human rights, whether in fact we respect human rights or whether we take actions which appear at least to convey the message that the war on terror is not, in fact, a war in defense of freedom and the rule of law, but is, in fact, a war against Islam. I'm not saying it is a war against Islam, but I'm saying that every time the United States engages in such human rights violations as the torture of Muslim suspects or the violation of the Geneva Convention in relationship to the treatment of Muslims at Guantanamo Bay, and many other examples, every time we do that, we make it much harder for moderates in the Muslim and Arab communities around the world to opt out of the terrorist vision, the terrorist message. And therefore, the key point here is that we will win the war on terror not just through our military might, important as that may be in certain elements of winning that war, but we will also win it only if we model respect for human rights and, in turn, respect for the vast majority of Muslims around the world who are not terrorists, never will be, but may be sympathetic to their quest.
Your most recent annual report on the state of human rights around the world, which you publish every year, says what you found brings shame to governments from Afghanistan to the United States and that the U.S. government is a leading purveyor and practitioner of torture and ill treatment. A claim that certainly, you know, there's a lot of evidence that some very bad things are happening around the world. The U.S. government certainly would deny, has denied, that it is a purveyor of torture. And I guess, you know, the question is, what can we say about the evidence, and what would you say about, you know, the claim that, you know, we're simply battling terrorists, and that we need to act a little tough, we need to do some things that maybe we're not comfortable with, but it is in the name of, you know, battling a greater evil?
Well, you've raised at least two issues here, I think. The first is the question of how we know that the United States is engaged in, or is a purveyor, to use the language there, a purveyor of torture around the world. And we know it not just through Amnesty International's investigations. We know it through reports of military commissions themselves that have looked into this question. We know it through testimony of FBI agents. We know it through the International Committee of the Red Cross, which has raised concerns about this. We know it through a wide variety of news reports. There's no question but what the United States has at least been a purveyor of torture, has utilized forms of torture and other mistreatment of detainees, ostensibly to get information or to humiliate those people or to intimidate them. And I think that the best evidence that the United States indeed is taking that posture has been the resistance which the administration displayed last December, just a few weeks ago, when both the House and the Senate overwhelmingly passed the so-called McLean Anti-Torture Amendment, which in effect said the United States has got to stop torturing people. And for week after week, led first by Vice President Cheney, the administration resisted making that simple statement, the simple statement that the United States would abide by its own laws and by its own international treaty obligations under the Convention Against Torture, of which we are a state's party. And indeed, when the president signed that legislation, finally bowing to the will of the Congress, the overwhelming will of both Republicans and Democrats, when he signed it in his so-called signing statement, which is the statement that is issued when a president signs a new piece of legislation, he in effect said, I'm going to ignore this. I'm going to do what I want, consistent with my interpretation of my constitutional duties as the chief executive. So the first issue you've raised is, how do we know that? And we know it from, in the last analysis, we know it from, in effect, the administration's own confession to their desire to at least keep this option on the table. Now, are we forced by the war on terror to take actions that we otherwise wouldn't like to take? There is certainly no question, but what many of the people who are in detention are bad guys who may well want to do us harm. Some of them may well have important information. And there are many appropriate tools which have been developed over the years by military intelligence interrogators, by the FBI, tools that involve duplicity, for example, tools that may involve certain forms of confusion that is generated in a detainee, comparison of information from one detainee to another. There are many, many different forms of interrogation that ultimately result in the extraction of important intelligence information. But the use of torture is almost invariably condemned by the most experienced interrogators, not only because it often results in erroneous information, but because in the long run it defeats the primary purpose of interrogation, which is to gather information that can provide us greater security and greater safety. Because as an American travels around the world, as I have done, and sees the posters in one country after another of that infamous picture from Abu Ghraib of the hooded prisoner with electric wires attached to his hands and his feet, one recognizes that when the United States debases its own highest values, when it compromises the image that we have always projected of being the world's greatest champion of human rights, we take upon ourselves the label of hypocrite, and we undermine our credibility in all of our efforts to gain support and allies around the world in the struggle against terror. Torture is ultimately a self-defeating policy.
Our guest this morning during the first hour Focus 580 is William Schultz. He's Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. We're talking about human rights and the impact of the war on terror. We have one caller who's been waiting patiently. I'll get them right into our conversation. Others are welcome if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with our first caller, someone from Indiana on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
It's almost psychic. The question I was going to ask you just answered very succinctly, and so I'll just add a couple of little things on that maybe you'll comment about them. When I've talked to people who often say, hey, these guys are killers. We got to use everything possible to get information out of them, no matter what it does to them. And then I bring up this argument you just stated that, in a sense, you're pulling the rug out underneath your own self by talking about human rights. And, you know, even today, you know, we make it, you know, requisite for... for example, in Palestine, the situation there, which we've essentially brought about, that people will look at you and sometimes they'll make comments. Some of the religious people I've talked to said, well, it's God's will. It's just the way things are, and that's that. And they seem to feel comfortable with that answer. But other people who, in a sense, pay attention to their thoughts and try to, you know, get them to gel somewhat, they sort of act befuddled, and sometimes they just act very angry at you and say, well, aren't you American or something like that. Now, my comment about this, years ago, I remember I had a Quaker friend who was harassed by some people, and because he was, you know, peace-oriented, and they brought him the same question. It's similar to the ones we talk about, the terrorists and what they might do. Well, wonder if somebody was attacking and raping your wife, would you shoot him? And they like to put people, you know, very much on the spot. And in some ways, it's time now to put the Moose administration on the spot by, you know, talking about this a lot, because it's just it's remarkable about young kids coming up who watch, you know, do the internet and they watch global TV, and here's this powerful, you know, bull out there doing just what the hell it wants to, basically, and saying one thing out of one side of its mouth and doing other things out the other side. Thanks a lot, and excellent work. I hope you guys keep up. And I do a little donating to Amnesty.
Well, thank you, sir.
But, I think you're an important organization.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that, and that provides an opportunity to plug our website at www.amnestyusa.org for others who are interested in learning more about our work. I'll just say this. You know, the United States is an enormously powerful country, militarily, economically, and so on. But even as powerful as we are, we need friends in the world. The President's State of the Union address is a perfect illustration of that. He talked about our overdependence on oil and the fact that if the United States is ever to be fully flexible in its foreign policy, we're going to have to reduce our dependence on foreign sources of oil. That's a perfect example of how, no matter how powerful we are, for our own economic well-being, we have certain dependencies on the alliances and friendships of other countries. The same is true with regard to our environmental health. Certainly it's true in Iraq, where we see how difficult it has been for the United States to, in effect, go it alone in trying to rebuild that country. And we alienate our friends when we appear to the world to be working at cross purposes with our rhetoric. President Bush has been eloquent in describing the war on terror as a war in defense of America's highest values, in defense of freedom around the world, in defense of the rule of law. That's fine, and every human rights advocate ought to be on the front line denouncing terrorists, attacks on civilians, innocent people killed. But at the same time, we have to recognize that our actions need to conform to our rhetoric, or we risk putting all of ourselves in a far more dangerous position.
I have a couple questions, you know, one of which it sort of gets to the heart of this thing about, well, what is the appropriate response to, you know, a terrorist organization that is intent on, you know, killing civilians and causing maximal damage. I think a lot of Americans feel outraged, and obviously, you know, we're here almost, you know, 5.5 years after 9/11, or 4.5 years, and perhaps our temper has been moderated a little bit. I think a lot of people felt immediately, you know, the gut reaction was whatever it takes, you know, to fight these evil people. But then you have to step back and examine, well, you know, what does that really mean, whatever it takes, and what are the impacts of, you know, that kind of response? You know, and I have to confess that my own reaction was similar. You know, I guess, you know, the question is, how do we deal with the very human reaction, you know, to acts of violence and criminal, acts of war, while also recognizing the impact of, you know, harsh, you know, and immediate gut reaction to that?
Well, we ought to be outraged by evil. We ought to be outraged by terrorists' attacks upon innocent people. One of the most fundamental of human rights articulated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is Article 3, which says that every single person has the right to security of person, to feel safe and to be safe in their homes and their communities. There's nothing wrong with feeling outrage. We need to acknowledge that. It's appropriate in those kinds of contexts. The problem is that you can't base policy on outrage alone. You know the old saying, don't get angry, get even. The fact is that policy needs to be based on wisdom, not just on outrage. It can be motivated initially by outrage, but it needs to be a policy that can most effectively achieve our ends. How do we deal with terrorist attacks? Well, we put at the disposal of our police and military forces whatever resources they need. We hone in using the best intelligence we possibly can on those who perpetrated that crime. We certainly do what we can to see that they're punished. Do we, at the same time, violate our fundamental values in the process of doing that? We don't have to do that, and we shouldn't do it. Do we divert attention from the focus on terrorists to go after an admittedly heinous government like Saddam Hussein's? Well, there's a lot of debate about whether, in fact, that has advanced the cause of fighting terrorism or exacerbated the number of terrorists in the world. And we will only know in the long run, depending upon what ultimately plays out in Iraq, whether it becomes a haven for terrorists and a recruitment center for terrorists, or whether, as the president suggests, the introduction of democracy, if in fact that happens there, will ultimately result in a more stable Middle East. We don't know the answer yet, but certainly that is an eminently debatable question. So there's nothing wrong with outrage at all. We all feel it. I certainly felt it. My offices are 30 blocks north of the World Trade Center. I lost people and members of our staff, lost members of their family in that killing. And certainly as I see other instances of terrorism around the world, the Madrid bombing, for example, of the train, I feel exactly that kind of outrage. But the Madrid bombing provides us a perfect example. Instead of getting smart and acting smart and getting even, as it were, in the sense of meeting out justice, the FBI went after a man named Brandon Mayfield, a lawyer in Portland, Oregon, who it thought was involved with the terrorist attack in Madrid. It short-circuited the process of checking fingerprints. It made very serious errors. And is it only a coincidence that Brandon Mayfield had converted to Islam a number of months before the FBI went after him? I don't know. I can't prove that. But that certainly is not an example of fighting terrorism in a smart way.
We have another call to talk with. We'll get right to them. Let me just reintroduce our guest. William Schultz is the Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. We're talking about the impact on human rights of the war on terror. He will also be addressing this topic tomorrow at the University YMCA Friday Forum lecture at noon, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign, and that's free and open to the public if you'd like to attend. Meanwhile, you can join us by calling 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Next caller in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. When you commented on the mistreatment at Abu Ghraib, you left something out. It must have been an oversight. But on your part, the people who mistreated prisoners at Abu Ghraib were not carrying out U.S. policy. They were criminals. They have been tried. Many of them are in jail. Another thing you neglected to mention was the fact that the president said in his last news conference, we do not torture. A reporter in that news conference challenged him to make an explicit denial of torture, and he did it. He, without hesitation, without any equivocation, he said, we don't torture. The Secretary of State has made that statement several times. Why don't you believe him?
Well, let me respond. In the first place, sir, you're simply incorrect that what happened at Abu Ghraib was not a result of policy set at higher levels than the intelligence officers and military guards who were, in fact, the immediate perpetrators of the torture. And the military commissions, there have been 10 of them so far. None of them have even been independent. They've almost all been run by the military itself. They have established unequivocally that there was extraordinary confusion at that level of the guards themselves because higher officials, Miller, General Sanchez, others, had issued orders going all the way up to Secretary Rumsfeld, who subsequently had to withdraw some of the permission that he had given for certain tactics to be pursued in relationship to the detainees. They had issued orders which could quite readily be understood to have authorized that kind of policy. Furthermore, in February of 2002, President Bush himself, in an executive order that he issued with regard to the treatment of detainees, said detainees are to be treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions, quote, to the extent appropriate to military necessity, unquote. That is a huge caveat. And while you are absolutely correct that the president has frequently made an unequivocal statement that the United States does not torture, you notice very clearly that the president has not made a similarly unequivocal statement that the United States does not engage in cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment, which is also outlawed by the Convention Against Torture. And you notice that the fact is that the president resisted, led by his vice president, for month after month after month, a resolution sponsored by Senator McCain of his own party, passed 90-9 in the Senate with approximately 40 Republican votes for it, that simply would have put on record in law the fact that the United States may not torture. That was resisted by the administration. And when the president finally signed the law, because he saw that his veto would be overridden, when he finally signed it, he, in his signing document, said, I will respect this law, yes, to the extent consistent with my constitutional obligations as the chief executive. And we know from memos, from arguments that he has made repeatedly, most recently in the wiretapping scandal, we know quite readily that the president interprets his power to allow the suspension of various kinds of commitments, including the commitment not to torture. So, you know, sir, I'm delighted the president says that. I've heard Secretary Rice say it personally to me. I've met with her several times. I understand all that. Unfortunately, the reality and the record belie the rhetoric.
I want to also talk a bit about Guantanamo Bay. It seems that, you know, if you read the article Seymour Hersh was publishing in The New Yorker during the breaking of the Abu Ghraib scandal, he basically detailed that many of the tactics that were employed in Abu Ghraib, there was a special team that was brought, I believe was active in Afghanistan and also Guantanamo Bay, that was charged with increasing the amount of intelligence that gathered from the detainees there, many, many thousands of them in Abu Ghraib and other Iraqi facilities. And according to Hersh, the order was to Gitmoize Abu Ghraib. In other words, apply the same techniques that were applied
General
in Guantanamo.
Jeffrey Miller was sent from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib to do that, yes.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, for a lot of people, it's been very murky what actually was going on in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Can you talk about that?
Well, of course, it is murky, and it's intentionally murky. Guantanamo Bay has been off limits to human rights groups. It has essentially been off limits to the press. The press are certainly given tours of certain parts of Guantanamo Bay, but are certainly not allowed access to the prisoners there. The United States has attempted to prevent the prisoners at Abu Ghraib from utilizing the U.S. court system to have their cases reviewed. And here's the problem. Again, of the 600 people who were originally incarcerated at Abu Ghraib, some 200 of them have already been released. Now, when they were incarcerated, Secretary Rumsfeld said, these are the worst of the worst, he said. These guys are so bad they will bite your nose off. And yet, over the next few years, 200 of them have been released. They must have had miracle conversions if they were the worst of the worst 4 years ago, and suddenly they're safe enough to be released. either that or they weren't guilty of what we suspected them of in the first place, or we have let out of prison guilty people without bringing them to trial to punish them. The problem is, how do we know which of the 600 are truly bad guys who did things that ought to be they ought to be punished for, they ought to be prosecuted, they ought to be brought up on charges, and if they're found guilty, they ought to be punished for them. How many of them are in that status, and how many of them were simply caught up in the fog of war in Afghanistan and ought to be released, as some 200 already have been? The problem is that because they are being held in incommunicado, indefinite detention, because they are only allowed to plead their case before certain military review commissions where they are not permitted and their lawyers are not permitted to confront the evidence against them so that they can't refute evidence. The problem is that we simply don't know, and you're absolutely right when you say it's murky. It's in very, very intentionally murky in order that the United States not have to follow standard due process procedures with regard to the holding of prisoners.
As I talk with people about these issues, people from all ends of the political spectrum, many of them are very uncomfortable with this concept of the enemy combatant. That there is a category of perpetrator or suspect that isn't covered by criminal law, it's not covered by military law of war, and it seems to be a very new entity all by itself. That really there seem to be very few rules.
You're absolutely right, and the folks you're talking to are uncomfortable with it, ought to be uncomfortable with it. It's a very discomforting notion. You know, let's just be clear about this. When you take someone prisoner in the course of war, you either decide to treat them as a prisoner of war, or if you do not believe that they meet the various criteria that the Geneva Conventions establish for the treatment of a prisoner as a prisoner of war, then you are required under the convention to bring them before a competent tribunal where they have an opportunity to defend themselves, to plead their case, to hear the evidence against them, and to have an independent judgment rendered. That has simply not happened in Guantanamo. And by declaring not only the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay combatants, enemy combatants, but also by declaring two U.S. citizens, Jose Padilla and Yasser Hamdi, who until very recently were both being held incommunicado in military brigs and labeled enemy combatants, with the government attempting to deny until recently their access to lawyers in the courts, you create, as you have said, a whole new category here of people who fall into limbo, who in effect disappear from the legal system, even U.S. citizens disappearing in effect into the bowels of a military brig without access to the court system. You either have to treat someone as a prisoner of war, or if they're not, then you have to decide, have they been guilty of war crimes? Have they been guilty of certain forms of conspiracy? And if that's the case, then they ought to be brought to trial. They ought to be convicted if the evidence is appropriate against them and they have their due process rights established. If they're convicted, they ought to be imprisoned. But you can't hold people indefinitely, incommunicado, in this way without access to the court systems and still call yourself a law-abiding, law-respecting country.
We're past our midway in the program here with William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, talking about human rights and the war on terror. We have one caller waiting and would welcome others if you'd like to join us. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And again, William Schultz will be speaking tomorrow at the University YMCA Friday Forum lecture at noon at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign. You're free to also attend that, and we'll carry on here. Several callers suddenly have joined us. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very good talk. It's a shame we can't get this kind of clear talk about this topic through our mainstream media. I was just wanted to ask you a question about the techniques themselves. Is there anything you could say about who's doing, what countries might be our source of R&D, so to speak, when it comes to torture, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I've not seen information with regard to particular countries that are sources of the types of torture that we've seen at Abu Ghraib and that we've documented at places like the U.S. Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. I suspect that intelligence officers and guards who undertook the kind of torture that we saw in the pictures from Abu Ghraib that we've heard about elsewhere didn't need inspiration to figure out how to humiliate people. At the same time, what's very important and what your question very clearly leads to is comment on the process of what is called extraordinary rendition. And this is a process whereby the United States transfers to the custody of countries like Egypt and Morocco prisoners who are then interrogated by those countries' officials, not by U.S. officials, countries which are notorious for their use of torture in the course of interrogation, countries that our own State Department, in its annual Human Rights Practices Report, denounces for their use of torture by the police and military. The United States transfers prisoners to countries like this because it wants to put some distance between itself and the treatment or mistreatment of those prisoners in custody of countries like that. But at the same time, it does enormous damage to the United States' reputation, again, as a law-abiding respecter of the rule of law, because these countries, which are allies of ours, do our dirty work, and we cannot escape responsibility. It has now been publicly revealed. There is a tremendous furor in Europe about whether plane flights have stopped at various points in Europe, or whether these detainees were held for certain lengths of time at places in Eastern Europe. It's blown up in our face, and I would venture to say that it would be very hard to prove that the information that has been obtained from these kinds of interrogations has been worth the enormous damage and greater danger to the United States' reputation that has resulted from our practice of extraordinary renditions in the first place.
Several callers are waiting. We'll go next to another Urbana listener, line number two. Hello.
It seems that our own justice system has been shown to have convicted and even executed totally innocent people, in part sometimes on the basis of the word of people who were totally unreliable. It seems even more likely to have happened in this situation. And I can see where, you know, if I wanted your land and I was unscrupulous, I might finger you to the U.S. government in Iraq or Afghanistan and get you out of the way. And I'm also concerned that, you know, if I were picked up and tortured and I was innocent, I would have a tremendous ill feeling toward the U.S. government. My family would. It seems to me that we are risking propagating the number of people who have a good reason to take revenge, especially in societies where revenge is considered honorable. It seems like we're just propagating terrorists as opposed to solving the problem.
Well, I think our caller makes several very, very good and important points. The first is that she's absolutely right. That, in fact, there is considerable documentation of the fact that a number of those who ended up at Guantanamo Bay were people who, as she said, were fingered by their enemies from some other tribe or clan or military branch in Afghanistan to get them out of the way. And the United States didn't know the difference and thought everyone was terrorists and slammed them into Guantanamo Bay. But the second point that the caller made is also an extraordinarily important point because, you know, I suspect that most of our listeners at one time or another have heard the argument, the so-called ticking bomb argument for torture. It's very simple. It suggests that would it not be defensible, indeed would it not be morally obligatory, to torture an individual if you thought you knew that individual had information about a ticking time bomb that was set to go off in the middle of a big city somewhere and would kill tens of thousands of people. If you could get information out of that person, wouldn't you be morally obligated to torture them to save
10,000 lives, in effect saying, on a strict cost-benefit utilitarian calculus basis, isn't it worth torturing one person in order to save the lives of 10,000? But what the people who propose that argument never take into account is exactly what our caller just said, that while it may be from a strictly counting point of view, a strictly cost-benefit point of view, it may be defensible to torture one person to save 10,000 lives, how do we know that individual who was tortured, or more likely that individual's family or community members or other people in the country from which that individual originated, will not be so angry, so resentful at the mistreatment of their brother, that they indeed take revenge on 100,000 people? And it is this kind of perpetuation of the revenge cycle that the use of torture facilitates.
The other thing is that in watching the aftermath of 9/11 and the attempt to figure out what went wrong, I saw Condoleezza Rice saying, who could have imagined anybody would have flown a plane into the World Trade Center? Well,
yes, well, that was just, of course, as we now know, just an outright misstatement. I won't say it was a lie, but we know that the administration had intelligence with a title that the United States was threatened. That was the title of the memo from the intelligence community, threatened by the possibility of planes being used as weapons.
Not only that, but the two boys who committed the massacre at Columbine High School had this fantasy of doing this.
Uh-huh.
And there was we had an early IBM PC, and one of the pieces of software you could buy, which was originated here, was Flight Simulator. And you could buy the software that showed the outlines of the approaches to various airports. I personally, on a computer simulator, years and years ago, it suddenly occurred to me, I accidentally have, on a computer, flown an airplane into the World Trade Center.
I see.
And it suddenly dawned on me, you know, lots of people have software where you could do this. It's not a big stretch of the imagination. If you are looking for ways for people to hurt us, if you're paying attention and not protecting your turf the way it seems as though the Bush administration was, you might have taken this more seriously. And if we can't take seriously the threats that are relatively obvious, why are we... What's the justification for looking for the inobvious things? I don't get it. I don't think we should be tolerating an administration that says we must have the rule of law for everybody else, but not for us. Thanks so much. It's very interesting.
Thanks for the call. Well, we have several calls and just about 12 or 14 minutes left in this hour, Focus 580. Let me just mention again, William Schultz is our guest. He's Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, talking about the war on terror and its impact on human rights. Two callers waiting and some lines open if you'd like to join us in the time remaining. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Go next to a Champaign County caller, line number 3. Good morning.
Regarding the where we get our torture information from, I think we're going to hear about that in the next hour. And I think the case that McCoy will make is that we've been exporting more of the information. There's the famous School of the Americas torture manual that was sent all over Latin America. So that's just on that point. The extreme rendition, there actually is an activist in this community right now who's out of Chicago, Kathy Kelly, who's done direct action at Aero Contractors in Smithfield, North Carolina, where 18 planes that are involved in extraordinary rendition is centered at. These are the planes that go around and deliver people. My question is, why should anybody believe these people? That was the headline in Der Spiegel when Rice said we don't torture. Does anybody believe this woman? With all of the other things going on, the investigation of Quaker meetings and that sort of stuff, why would anybody believe that that this administration is going to be responsible in looking at data files? There's some evidence that Cheney was already abusing the NSA prior to 9/11. Jason Leopold, you can look for that one. But I thank you for your work, and I'm sure we'll. You'll have a great audience tomorrow, and thanks. I'll just let the calls go on. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know if you have any comments on that. Feel free to make them. There's a lot there. But you know, the issue of extraordinary rendition is such a euphemism, and I guess I wonder, you know, as we throw these terms around, enemy combatant and rendition, I mean, it seems that, you know, the definitions are kind of important. Has the word terrorism even been defined?
Well, you make a very good point, Jack. The fact is that the international community, and this is a great failing of the United Nations, but it's also, I have to say, a failing of the human rights community for not pushing more successfully for this. The international community has not established a clear definition of terrorist and terrorism. There is, of course, the constant refrain, well, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And there has been great resistance, particularly in certain parts of the developing world, for the labeling of people who are perceived in those contexts to be fighting for the freedom of minority groups or groups that were discriminated against or groups that are out of power in a context of an authoritarian government. There's been very great resistance to clarifying this definition of terrorism. But I think that it's not as complicated as it seems. Because what all terrorists have in common is that they target civilians, that they target non-combatants. And we can get into a long argument about whether we ought to regard a terrorist as someone who attacks police and military officials. But when they attack civilians who are not a part of the conflict, then clearly you have, in that context, a terrorist act, and you have it whether it is perpetuated by non-governmental groups or by governments themselves. When governments themselves perpetuate attacks upon civilians and other forms of discrimination against civilians, they themselves can be accused of certain forms of what is usually labeled state terrorism.
Very good. Have another caller waiting. We'll go next to an Urbana listener, line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. How are you? I supported your organization for years financially, and I still will, always will. But I think the issue, as you were saying earlier, there's no real definition for terrorism. Well, Europe, you know, in the World War II, they killed, Germans killed all these Jews, the Jews and the, you know, anybody else they considered not just terrorists, but they didn't like, so the Germans were considered terrorists after the war. I know you could, you know, sort of stretch that definition, and that's one of the problems. But in sort of, in a way, I think of this... And you were talking about non-combatants in killing civilians. Well, 35 years ago, I was in the military. They used to call that collateral damage.
Yes, right.
You know, you'd call in an airstrike, and you know the enemy was over there, and all of a sudden they missed by 100 meters or 200 meters or 1,000 yards, wipe out, you know, people. There was no intent there. But then it's a really complex issue. But one of the things I'd like to discuss, or you to discuss, is the fact that in an ideal environment, these ideologies such as rights and human rights and stuff are, and I'm really for this. I'm really against people abusing. I don't like people torturing anybody. But the environment has changed because if you could get those 1,000 terrorists and you gave them, or 250 of them or a quarter of them, got some devices, not just, I'm not going to go into the little, you know, scare tactics, but some, you know, biological weapons and things like that, surreptitiously and kill millions of people, I'm afraid that all of these ideologies and these ideals will just go completely out the door and everybody will start slaughtering everybody. And that's what really worries me. And I think the government, in a sense, is pandering to that sort of idea. And I don't like that. I think that is very unfair. But I think the issue is relevant.
Well, you make several important comments here. Certainly, there is a distinction between, as you have said, between collateral damage that takes place within a military context as long as the issue of intent is clear. I think the law itself recognizes that in any military action, there may well be innocent civilians caught up in that action. And the question is a question of proportionality. If indeed the number of civilians who are injured or killed in a military action is disproportionate to the goal of that military action, then you have a serious problem and potentially a war crime on your hands. That, of course, is a very different situation from the intentional targeting of civilians. The other point you make
is that if indeed there are more widespread terrorist attacks, will we not all be driven to violation of our ideals and our highest values? And I think that that's a real danger. I don't discount that at all. At the same time, I will say that, again, as I mentioned earlier, I think that we have to ask ourselves, what is the most effective way? I'm not making an argument for human rights in this case on moral grounds. I'm making a very pragmatic argument for the respect of human rights and the respect of the rule of law. And just as in our own criminal justice system, when someone goes on a rampage, as we saw in Goleta, California yesterday, the day before, in that former postal worker who killed, what, six, seven, eight former coworkers. When someone goes on a rampage like that, certainly those of us, all of us, feel the need to punish that person. The family members feel enormous desires for revenge. But we have a system of laws which is designed to deal with that in a formal way, just in order that we don't all indulge ourselves in our most, what shall we say, I don't want to use the word base passions, but certainly our most visceral feelings that are first evoked by any kind of outrage like that. We all know that it's best, I think we all know when we're going to write a nasty letter to someone, that it's often best to wait 24 hours and see how we feel then. And the same principle applies here, that while the initial reaction to the killing of innocent people in whatever context is a desire for revenge, a desire to harm the perpetrator of the crime, we all know that in the long run, the way to protect ourselves as a society most effectively is to abide by those fundamental principles and processes that we've established for dealing with this kind of crime.
A couple callers waiting. We'll go on next to a cell phone, listener on a cell phone on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes.
I've got two questions. First, does the Bush administration claim that nobody in Guantanamo is innocent? And second, for comparative purposes, what is the rate that suspects in murder trials in the United States are convicted? I'm especially interested in how many are found innocent. Thank you for listening, and I'll listen on the radio.
Okay.
Well, with regard to the first question, I think that the Bush administration has made the argument before the review commissions that are charged with reviewing the cases of the 400 and some prisoners or 350 that remain at Guantanamo. The Bush administration, or the military certainly, acting at the behest of the administration, has opposed the release of those people. So I would presume that they have opposed it because they believe that those people remain threats to the United States. Now, whether they believe that they have committed outright crimes, I don't know. I have no idea, and that's part of the problem. Whether they believe that they are potential threats, they clearly, I think, do. And in that sense, they think that they are guilty at least of being a potential threat. Now, under the laws of war, you can hold a prisoner of war only so long. And when the hostilities cease, they have to be released and repatriated to their home country. The administration is making the argument that the war on terror may never end, and then at least theoretically it means that those people can be held indefinitely. I don't know what the rate of conviction or rulings of not guilty in the criminal justice system is. I don't know. I simply don't have the answer to that question. It's an interesting question, and perhaps one of our callers can check it on the internet, perhaps.
Okay.
But what I do know, certainly in capital cases, what we have seen at this point is that over 110 people who had been convicted of capital cases have been subsequently released because they were found to have been erroneously convicted. It doesn't mean they were all not guilty, but it means that they were erroneously convicted. And we know, therefore, that our criminal justice system is flawed.
We literally have about 2 minutes left, and I'm sorry there's a caller we won't be able to get on the air. I did want to ask, as a way of sort of rounding out the conversation, to have you talk a bit about how do we define the basis and meaning of human rights, and given the state of conflict around the world, how do we be champions of those ideas while also, you know, dealing with our security concerns?
Well, human rights are pretty clearly defined in such documents as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the various conventions and treaties that have grown out of them, the Convention Against Genocide, the Covenant on Social, Economic, and Cultural Rights, and so on. So that there is a pretty clear legal basis, a basis within international law and policy for human rights, and those conflicts are adjudicated by such courts as the European Court of Human Rights and so on. And I think that we remain champions of human rights without in any way compromising our security. Indeed, I would argue that practicing respect for human rights is one of the best ways to reinforce our security, because the creation of a structure of accountability at the international level, as manifest, for example, in the International Criminal Court, those are among the best chances we have for building a safe, secure world that respects the rule of law.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there, but let me just mention again that our guest, William Schultz, director of Amnesty International USA, will be speaking in Urbana-Champaign tomorrow at the University YMCA Friday Forum Lecture Series at 12 noon. His talk there is entitled Tainted Legacy, 9/11, and the Ruin of Human Rights. And for anyone who is listening to the show, you are welcome to attend. There's a free admission, and they also have a very nice Thai eatery there, by the way. So if you'd like to hear more from William Schultz, you can visit him there. And to you, Dr. Schultz, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure, Jack. Thank you.
Thank you.